Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, November 25th, 2024 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, then I'll read the cover story, points of progress. Hey, guess what? Science and Nature's AWOL again, so I will read the explainer. And then the home forum, which has a recipe, so be prepared for that. And then the monitor's view. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled An Unlikely Thanksgiving Story. This is written by Noelle Swan, who is the editor of the weekly edition. You can email her at nswan@csmonitor.com. And she writes, Thanksgiving is a big deal around the monitor. For one day, public conversation aligns with some of the values that we hold dearest. Gratitude, generosity, community, family. Yet in recent years, the U.S. discourse around the annual feast has taken a more contentious tone, as concerns long expressed by Native American communities have found footing in more mainstream conversations. Beneath this joyous and loving celebration lies a fraught history. Many indigenous communities observe the fourth Thursday of each November with a day of mourning for the widespread killing of their ancestors at the hands of European colonists. More recently, some have gone so far as to rename it Unthanksgiving Day. As the holiday season approached, Monitor editors considered addressing this latest rift in the culture wars head on. It's the kind of story that we do well. And yet, in a year marked by intense division, it didn't feel quite right to lean into the controversy. It is true that the narrative of the first Thanksgiving that many Americans were taught is rife with inaccuracies and stereotypes. But it is also true that, however flawed its origin story, this day has come to represent some truly wonderful things. What story could we tell, we wondered, that would amplify the gracious tone of the holiday without stroking the hurt felt around its painful history? Our first thought was to explore the idea of gratitude from an indigenous perspective. I brought the idea to the two writers at the Monitor most focused on indigenous issues, Henry Gass and Sarah Miller Lana. Together, Sarah and Henry have carved out a borderless beat covering Native American and First Nations communities. Did they think this idea would be feasible? Would indigenous communities even want to participate in a story timed around Thanksgiving? Might they find it insulting to be asked? Henry and Sarah first caution that there is no singular indigenous perspective. There are 574 Native American tribes and Alaska Native entities in the United States, and 630 First Nations communities in Canada. Each one has its own history, values, and cultural narratives. So would they find the timing of our inquiry around Thanksgiving objectionable? There could be no single answer to that question. Some might welcome the opportunity to help shape a Thanksgiving story, but others could be offended. Fair enough. The two writers looked back at their reporting on both sides of the border. By focusing on gratitude, would we even be asking the right question, they asked. If we want to offer an indigenous perspective, should we be setting the storyline ourselves? In the end, we found the cover story that anchors this Thanksgiving issue. It turned out not to be an American story at all, and it carries many hallmarks of the Thanksgiving story told in the United States. I'll let you discover how that story unfolds. But for me, it is a reminder that the goodness we honor on Thanksgiving Day need not be a casualty of historical reckoning. In fact, it doesn't need to be tied to any single day. We can keep it with us all year long. And that was the From the Editor column written by Noelle Swan, who is the editor of the weekly edition. And this week it was entitled, An Unlikely Thanksgiving Story. And now for the cover story. This week it's entitled, Common Traditions of Giving Thanks. In Canada, Acadian descendants and the Mi'kmaq remember when they gathered to celebrate the harvest and good cheer. This is written by Sarah Miller Lana, who is a staff writer. From Port Royal and Bear River First Nation, Nova Scotia, Paul Lalonde adjusts his glossy beaver felt hat and welcomes the visitors gathered around a long table to his order of good cheer. This year, he explains, is 1606, and winter is coming to the banks of the Bay of Fundy. He and his French compatriots barely survive their first winter, unprepared for the harsh conditions that blast through these parts of Canada. They only survived here, in present-day Nova Scotia, with the aid of the Mi'kmaq, the indigenous people of the area. That's why the colonists and Mi'kmaq, he says to the guests watching him bring this history alive, are seated around this table, set with pewter plates and cups, about to dig into a hearty moose muffle stew, or perhaps beaver tail seared over a burning hearth. Mr. Lalande is an interpretive officer for Parks Canada, and part of his job is to reenact or interpret events that happened at the habitation at Port Royal, a full-scale replica of one of the first European settlements in North America 4 centuries ago. Today, in his wood-buttoned black wool doublet, he's playing the part of a 17th-century French colonist and member of L'Ordre des Bons Temps, the French name, and eating an entertainment club established with a royal charter, like similar orders in France. These rotating feasts are also considered an early Thanksgiving, a holiday most Canadians today experience more as a harvest festival in the early fall, but that some historians also trace to the meals in Port Royal's common room. The story shares similarities with the American narrative of Plymouth Rock. The Mi'kmaq, who had lived here for thousands of years, brought the sick and starving colonists both food and their ways of healing. We've always operated with the understanding that everybody in the world is in relation with one another, whether we admit it or not, and our job is to make those relations good, says Mercedes Peters, sharing our stories coordinator at the Mi'kma'way Debert Culture Center near Truro, Nova Scotia. But there the similarities mostly end. In the United States, the first Thanksgiving at Plymouth Rock is part of America's founding lore, a moment that commemorates the birth of a people. In Canada, the holiday is not wrapped up in the colonial narrative, nor is it as fraught with controversy over the reality of colonist violence against Indigenous people. The story of Port Royal's L'Ordre des Bons Temps, one of Canada's early Thanksgivings, recalls a moment in history when French colonists and the Mi'kmaq chiefs shared a relationship based on respect and reciprocity. That distinct relationship would evolve over time with the descendants of those first French colonists, a people who would come to be called Acadians. Mr. Lalande, an Acadian, looks across the habitation's common room at his guests here today. Who do you invite to sit at your table? You invite your friends. You invite the people you trust. A half-hour drive from the habitation sits the Mi'kmaq community of Bear River First Nation, which is called Lisitkuk in the Mi'kmaq language. Each October, Lisitkuk, on the edge of the fertile Annapolis Valley, Nova Scotia's breadbasket, holds an annual harvesters' gathering, just as their people have for thousands of years. This year, the annual celebration began the day after Canada's official Thanksgiving Day, which is designated as the second Monday of October. But the harvesters' gathering is not a date on a calendar, says Gerald Glode, a Mi'kmaq elder and educator at the Mi'kma'way Debert Cultural Center. Instead, it's the time of year when the tides in the Bay of Fundy, which has the largest tidal range in the world, are at their peak. It is the time of year when hunted game are large and healthy and at their nutritional peak. Our fish stocks are at a premium, Mr. Glode says. The bass are in, the salmon are back, and the sea-run trout. At this time of year, the Mi'kmaq always listen for the singing of grasshoppers and crickets to stop, he says. It's a sign of the end of humidity and an indicator to start drying fish for the winter. Everything is based on pattern recognition and our connection to the environment, Mr. Glode says. So that's part of our traditional and ecological knowledge based on where the planet is. That's when we celebrate. It's not a specific date. This harvester's gathering starts with a sunrise ceremony and the lighting of a sacred fire, which will burn continuously for 4 days. Over that time, community members give thanks to the land. They also honor those who hunt, fish, and gather throughout the year. Community members roast traditional foods like moose, deer, and salmon. They also serve turkey and luski, a Mi'kmaq bread, and boil corn and lobster. At this year's gathering, participants were taught how to use the atlatl, a spear-throwing hunting tool that predates the bow and arrow. The Mi'kmaq recognize modern Thanksgiving, too, as do Indigenous peoples across Canada. But it's at the harvester's gathering where they express gratitude. It's about enjoying the year's bounty, says Carol Ann Potter, a counselor at Bear River First Nation. It's to truly give thanks to land, to Mother Earth, and to harvesters. For Lisit Cook and other Mi'kmaq communities, the harvester's gathering is a celebration of a way of life based on Tipitnui, a concept that expresses their values of giving, especially during the harvest. Tipitnui is when people generously give away what they have hunted, gathered, or made, honoring the intention of doing good things for others, one poster at the cultural center explains. With an understanding of the interconnection of all peoples and their value of Tipitnui, the Mi'kmaq gave generously to the first French colonists in Nova Scotia as they struggled to survive. When the first feast put on by the Order of Good Cheer was organized at Port Royal in 1606, the Mi'kmaq would have just concluded their own seasonal gathering to mark the harvest. The famous French explorer Samuel de Champlain was one of the founders of the settlement at Port Royal. He would later settle Quebec City in 1608. He believed the colonists' survival depended not only on access to food, but also on good cheer, which he was confident would help stave off scurvy and give colonists the fortitude to endure the winter. So he obtained a royal charter to found the Order of Good Cheer for the gentlemen of the colony, which became a coat of arms. Its first recorded feast was November 14, 1606. At each gathering, one member was appointed chief steward. Wearing a special collar around his neck and the order's medallion, the chief steward would march in with serving plates he filled with mallard and partridge, moose, caribou, beaver, otter, and even wildcat, whatever might outdo the previous week's host. The order's practices were set down by the first chief steward, Marc Lescarbot, a lawyer and poet in the colony of Port Royal. According to his book, Histoire de la Nouvelle France, or History of the New France, the meals served here rivaled the offering on the Rue aux Arts, a Paris street known for its rotisseries. At that first feast, Lescarbot also composed and directed the first European play performed in North America, Théâtre de Neptune, an ode to the promise of New France in a new world. But what set this eating club apart from the chartered establishments in Europe was the presence of the Mi'kmaq as guests. As Lescarbot explains, as for Sagamos, Grand Chief, Membertou, and other chiefs who came from time to time, they sat at the table, eating and drinking like ourselves, he wrote, and we were glad to see them, while, on the contrary, their absence saddened us. The first feast at the Order of Good Cheer is described by Canada's National History Society as an early first Thanksgiving, but the story goes well beyond an account of colonists' friendly encounters with local peoples, who provided food and help colonists survive, says Andrew McLean, a writer and podcaster who recalls the history of Atlantic Canada. The Order of Good Cheer explicitly flipped the old world order on its head, he writes in his book, Backyard History, a compilation of the columns he had published about the history of the region. All were treated as equals, men, women, children, Catholics, Protestants, Mi'kmaq people, white people, and black people. There was definitely a business side to things, says Mr. McLean in an interview. There's a mutual benefit rather than just one side being nice for the sake of it. The two groups were bonded by pragmatics. The French traded metal tools, fabric, blue dye, and weapons. The Micmac taught the colonists their nutritional and medicinal know-how that essentially kept them alive. Indeed, it was not the good cheer of the eating club, but likely the vitamin C in the Micmac recipe for pine needle tea that helped colonists survive, says Ms. Peters at the Micaway Debert Cultural Center. There is a friendship there in the beginning, she says, but when I hear people look at Eurocentric points of view and how things are presented as French people and Micmac, or European settlers and the indigenous folks getting along, this isn't just everything was hunky-dory, because it wasn't. It was difficult and it was hard. Simplistic and rosy narratives ultimately serve only to reinforce the mythology of colonization. And it should never be forgotten, she adds, that Micmac perspectives went unrecorded. After a century of blood-soaked wars between France and Britain and North America, in 1755 the British began to forcibly remove Acadians, who had already evolved their own dialects and cultural traditions from the region. Acadians remember the expulsion as Le Grand Derangement, or the Great Disturbance. Over 11,000 of an estimated 14,000 Acadian inhabitants were forcibly removed and scattered throughout the 13 colonies and Europe. Thousands died en route. Descendants of those expelled French settlers also include Louisiana's Cajun people, whose name is derived from an evolved and quickly spoken version of Acadian. The Micmac, who suffered the same grievances as indigenous peoples across Canada as victims of colonial land grabs, forced assimilation, and residential schooling, assisted Acadians during Le Grand Derangement. And while the relationship has faltered since colonization, Micmac leaders acknowledge the close relationship they once had with Acadian settlers. We had similar ideals, says Tim Bernard, executive director of the Micaway Debert Culture Center. The French weren't coming here and saying, move out. We're moving in. The Micmac and the French had a better relationship because of the reciprocity that the French showed to the nation, Mr. Bernard continues, and that's part of what the culture has been built around. The British didn't have that. The British said, we're going to conquer you. Acadian people still recognize how crucial the Micmac were to their very existence. The Acadians owed much to the Micmac since the beginning, says André Carl Avachon, a prize-winning historian who has written 11 books on Acadian history. Many recognize this and recognize it even today. The two peoples exchanged ideas and intermingled. Mr. Vachon cites the words of Champlain in 1633 to underline French attitudes toward the Micmac. Nos garçons se mariant avec vos filles et nous se serons plus qu'un people. Forgive my French. Our boys will marry your daughters and we will be one people. In the key moment that brought the two groups closer, Grand Chief Membertou converted to Catholicism in 1610, receiving the baptismal name Henri in honor of the French king. When Robert McEwen, a member of the Bear River First Nation Council, thinks about how the British burned down the habitation, he gets unsettled. But it's not the way a Native American might feel unsettled about Plymouth Rock. His mother worked at the Port Royal replica for 25 years. He worked special events and then took over for his mother for 2 years before being elected as a councilor in 2021. A craftsman who builds boxes with porcupine quills and traditional games made with carved wooden pieces, Mr. McEwen has also taught traditional techniques inside a teepee on the site. And that's spelled T-I-P-I. He says he has made visitors cry, telling them the story of indigenous dispossession over the centuries. His own tenure at the habitation at Port Royal included building a traditional community drum. He'd sing so loud, loud and proud, Mr. McEwen says, that he swears the music could be heard across the bay. But the story of the Order of Good Cheer is not a story that is central to his own narrative or identity, or to any of the Micmac interviewed for this piece. Still, Mr. Bernard recognizes that moment when his people sat across the table from the first French colonists. He comes to the same conclusion that the Acadian interpretive officer, Mr. Lalonde, does about the feasts once put on in the dining hall of the habitation at Port Royal. "I think it's safe to say that everybody felt safe around that table," Mr. Bernard says. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. All right, now for points of progress in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is a map of the world with points indicated on it, and then a paragraph or two or three or sometimes four describing that point. Number one, Mexico. A preschool mandate set up children for success. Mexico began requiring 3 years of preschool education in 2004. Children born right after the cutoff date who went to preschool under the mandate performed better on math and Spanish tests in fifth and sixth grades than those born right before the cutoff date, a recent study found. They were also more likely to pay attention in class, take part in extracurricular activities, and do their homework, and less likely to skip classes. Students affected by the mandate were 9% more likely to finish high school and 11% more likely to attend some college. Studies in high-income countries have shown mixed results on the outcomes for children receiving early childhood education. But the researchers in Mexico suggest that preschool policies implemented at scale in lower and middle-income countries could have lasting effects. That was from something called VoxDev. Number two is Argentina. Homicides have plunged in a drug trafficking hotspot. Considered the least safe city in Argentina, Rosario has struggled to address violence. That has changed in the past year. Homicides have fallen 65%, a success attributed to increased police presence, more coordination among different levels of government, and a change in local law that is allowing the prosecution of gang members operating from prison. Waiting times for police to arrive when called dropped from an average of 20 minutes to 6 to 8 minutes. Firearm injuries were down 57% in the first half of 2024 compared with the same period of 2023. And cocaine seizures increased by 500%. With petty crime has increased possibly as a result of a spike in poverty attributed to President Javier Milei's fiscal austerity. But in September, the city went a month without any homicides for the first time since 2013. That was from Bloomberg and something called InfoBAE. Number three is Slovenia. Slovenia, that is correct. A national culture of beekeeping is protecting pollinators. These insects are crucial for the health of crops and wild plants, but their populations are declining worldwide. Around 40% of invertebrate pollinators, such as bees and butterflies, are at risk of extinction. Slovenia is home to 11,000 professional beekeepers, more per capita than any other country in Europe, and caring for these pollinators starts early. Beekeeping clubs are active at close to a third of Slovenia's primary schools. In 2011, it became the first nation to ban neonicotinoids, a type of pesticide that is toxic to bees. Because conserving wildflower meadows safeguards pollinator habitats, 12 hectares, or about 30 acres, of meadows in the capital of Ljubljana are not mowed until late June, an initiative that has won support among residents. The National Beekeepers Association also distributes pollinator-friendly tree saplings and hosts a planting day each March. World Bee Day was first inaugurated in Slovenia on May 20, 2018, and is now celebrated around the world. That was from Reasons to be Cheerful and something called Cabby Reviews. Number four, India, China, and Thailand. Robot boats are clearing trash out of waterways across Asia. Most of the plastic trash that reaches the ocean starts in rivers and coastlines. Researchers and developers are designing tools to help remove waste and gather data. One boat, ClearBot collects over 400 pounds of garbage per hour, methodically sucking up trash in a way the founder compares to the robot vacuum Roomba. The project began at the University of Hong Kong. It now operates in locations ranging from the Ganges River in India to the Mai Po Nature Reserve in Hong Kong, where it uses artificial intelligence to detect and remove the eggs of invasive snails. In Bangkok, the boats move algae off lakes using conveyor belts. They can also map waterway floors, test water quality, and help clean oil spills. And that was from CNN. And last but not least, it doesn't have a number, but it's entitled World. Clean energy requires less mining than fossil fuels. All sources of power need metals and minerals to deliver electricity, from the steel used in wind turbines to the lithium in batteries. Mining those materials can be harmful for the environment and people. Yet studies show that sticking with the status quo would be far more material intensive than transitioning to cleaner sources of power. Coal requires 1.2 million kilograms of mined waste rock per gigawatt hour of electricity it generates. That's 20 times more material than what's needed by onshore wind, which uses more metals, minerals, and rock than other low-carbon electricity sources. Technological improvements are also making solar panels, batteries, and wind turbines more efficient, further reducing the need for mining and materials. And that was from Our World in Data, and all that was compiled by Erica Page, who is a staff writer. Well, like I mentioned at the top of the show, science and nature is AWOL once again, but fortunately they do have the explainer. Unfortunately, it's only one page when it's usually two, and that cover story was very short, but we'll get through this. So, the explainer, it is entitled, Why Do We Eat Turkey on Thanksgiving? Here's some information to gobble up. This is written by Kendra Norden Beto, who is a staff writer. Let's talk turkey. How did this large fowl, which has paraded unchallenged for centuries as the holiday centerpiece, come to be synonymous with an iconic American tradition? Read on for some turkey trivia to share around the table. What follows is a question and answer piece. Question: How much turkey do Americans eat? Answer: Farmers in the United States raise 210 million to 250 million turkeys a year, says Leslie Odin, CEO of the National Turkey Federation. The highest producing state is Minnesota, with 37 million birds, followed by North Carolina and Arkansas. Over the Thanksgiving holiday alone, Americans will dine on about 40 million pounds of turkey, says Ms. Odin. In 2023, Americans ate more than 5 billion pounds of turkey, about 15 pounds per person, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Question: Where are turkeys from? Answer: Wild turkeys are indigenous to North America, having foraged their way from Central America up to eastern Canada. They were domesticated in Mexico by the Aztecs, who roasted the guajolote on a large spit and used its feathers to decorate clothing and blankets. Spaniards brought the bird back to European trading markets in the 1500s, where it soon found its way to fancy English dinner parties. Wealthy English who loved to impress guests with exotic birds as a meal centerpiece named the fowl after the far-off place some merchants had carted it from. Turkey. The name stuck. Question: Didn't Benjamin Franklin think that turkey should be the national bird? Answer: Not exactly. Remember that Franklin was a satirist. In January 1784, Franklin privately wrote to his daughter, Sarah Bach, "For my own part, I wish the bald eagle had not been chosen as a representative of our country." In context, Franklin was critiquing a rather dumpy drawing of an eagle lacking a regal beak by the Society of the Cincinnati, which had adopted the nation's bird as its symbol. The national punchline was that the Cincinnati eagle looked more like a turkey. In short, think of Franklin's letter to his daughter as an early dad joke. Question: Why is turkey associated with Thanksgiving? Answer: The only existing eyewitness account of diplomatic talks between the settling English and the Wampanoag Tribe is a 1621 journal entry that includes numerous references to bagging fowl, which came to be interpreted as the roaming turkey. A century on, a turkey appeared firmly rooted in American culinary literature and practices. Amelia Simmons' 1796 American Cookery, widely considered the first American cookbook, includes instructions on how to stuff and roast a turkey or fowl. In 1827, novelist Sarah Josepha Hale romanticized the role of the turkey in Northwood, A Tale of New England, in which she describes the ideal Thanksgiving dinner. The roasted turkey took precedence on this occasion, being placed at the head of the table, and well did it become its lordly station. Later, Hale launched a letter-writing campaign to politicians imploring them to make the Northeast tradition of Thanksgiving feast a nationwide holiday. She is largely credited with influencing Abraham Lincoln to declare a national day of Thanksgiving and praise in 1863 amid the Civil War. And for the final question, why does the president pardon turkeys? And the final answer, it's unclear which president first officially pardoned a turkey. Some say it was Lincoln, who turned a turkey into a family pet. Others say it was John F. Kennedy. Regardless, for the past 76 years, the National Turkey Federation has been delivering a live turkey to the White House. George H.W. Bush officially made the pardon an annual event. The National Turkey Federation chairman has the honor of keeping the presidential flock. Two turkeys are selected from the flock for the voyage to Washington, explains Ms. Odin, in case the official turkey gets stage fright. To prepare for the trip, the turkeys are carefully tended to by the farmer, who exposes them to camera lights, pom-poms, music, and crowds. Then comes an informal beauty pageant to select the finest turkey in the land. It's the one that ultimately struts around the best, has the most beautiful feathers, and really, most important, is their temperament, says Ms. Odin. They are going to meet the leader of the free world, and we want to make sure that they act on their best behavior. This year, the turkeys will travel from a Minnesota farm by private coach. Once in Washington, they'll be put up in a hotel suite at the Willard Intercontinental to rest up for their big moment. Then it's back on the coach for the trek home to Minnesota, where they will live out their lives at Farm America, an educational farm, as feathered ambassadors. And now for the Home Forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. And there's one article, and I will read it. And remember, there is a recipe that in this show or in this article that I will read after I read the article. So, this is entitled, The Day the Blessings Fell at My Feet. It took a near injury and a dreaded chore for me to appreciate the frozen bounty under my nose. This is written by Danny Heitman. When I opened our kitchen freezer one recent morning, a batch of persimmon fruit dropped to the floor and barely missed my toe. Persimmon pulp is a lovely golden thing, but when frozen, it's as hard as a hockey puck. I counted myself fortunate after the near miss, but our freezer looked poised for an even bigger landslide. Sighing, I decided to cull the shelves, a chore that seemed about as pleasant as sorting my sock drawer. Even so, a task I dreaded soon made me feel deeply grateful, a sentiment I'm trying to keep alive as another Thanksgiving rolls around. Digging through packages white with frost, I couldn't believe how many treasures I found. I had forgotten about those two bricks of diced ham, perfect for a pot of split pea soup. In the far reaches of a corner, deep in Arctic sleep, sat two sacks of summer corn. Along with the sausage I'd fished out, I now had the basic ingredients of mock shoe, a simple but satisfying corn dish inspired by Creole and Native American cultures, guaranteed to brighten the gray autumn day. Other delicacies rolled forward and announced themselves as I ferried the contents of each frigid shelf to the kitchen counter. There was a bright red bag of spaghetti sauce, no doubt just as good as when I stirred it to perfection a year ago. In a great stroke of serendipity, I came across a loaf of garlic bread as a compliment. Fish fillets from my brother, peaches for a future cobbler, and biscuits ideal for Sunday brunch added to the sumptuous tableau. Orange juice and chicken, peas and bell peppers, ice cream, sherbet, and casseroles spilled into view, too. All in all, I felt as rich as Midas and suddenly sated. The way I figured it, we wouldn't need to stock up at the grocery store for a week or two. I also felt a little bit chastened. Why had I groused just moments earlier about managing our surplus of food, which was really a singular blessing? My morning dive into our freezer underlined a few basics about gratitude I want to embrace, especially in this season that celebrates thankfulness. Be alert to abundance rather than absence. A simple fact of life is that we tend to see what we look for. I greeted my overflowing freezer as an obstacle when it was really an opportunity to savor my good fortune. It reminded me of other times when I've been oblivious to the wealth of my days. Like many others buffeted by inflation, my wife and I have cut back on travel and restaurant outings, a change I first felt as a loss. But the shift has freed more time at home, and we're connecting more deeply with the nature in our backyard and with loved ones who visit our patio. When we consciously look for what's good, it reveals itself more often. Savor details. In the autumns of my childhood, our holiday coloring books often pictured horns of plenty, those cone-shaped baskets of fruits and vegetables that symbolize Thanksgiving bounty. At first glance, the scene just looked like spilled produce. But in working our crayons over each item, the orange pumpkin, the scarlet grapes, the yellow squash, we came to understand that plenitude lives in particulars, and that's not one thing but many. I reconnected with this truth as I scanned our freezer, called once again to the kind of gratitude that reads life is a story with many layers. Seen this way, gratitude can be an adventure, an exercise not only in piety but also in imagination. And simplify. Mary Stein, my librarian friend, once told me that after her shelves are culled, patrons check out more books than before. Simplifying the collection allows visitors to better grasp the real gems. That basic principle seems to work at home, too. Cleaning out our freezer inspired me to weed our living room bookcase and winnow my closet. That meant reconnecting with novels I haven't read, and poetry I wanted to revisit, neckties I'd overlooked, and pants and shirts that now, in being reclaimed, have given me a new wardrobe. In thinning my household, I have, paradoxically, gained more. And share. The wonder of abundance is that when it's shared, gratitude grows, which is why holidays like Thanksgiving feature communal feasts. I've tried to cultivate that practice in other parts of my life. When our freezer rendered ingredients for a mock shoe, a popular dish in my home state of Louisiana, I thought how good it would look at the center of a table graced by friends. As mock shoe simmered in our kitchen, I remembered that bag of frozen persimmons that had slid from our freezer, taking me on an unplanned odyssey of gratitude. Hopefully, future blessings won't have to fall at my feet before I notice them. And now, before I read the recipe, I'm going to stop recording this show, wake up my snoring dog who is laying at my feet, and escort him to another room. I'll be back. Okay, the snoring canine has been woken up and removed to another room, but I didn't close any doors, and so he will probably come back and start snoring again. Anyway, here's what this says here. Mock shoe, it's spelled MAQUECHOUX, but they say right here it's pronounced mock shoe, is a popular Cajun dish in Louisiana thought to have been adapted from Native American cuisine. There are many variations, and part of the joy in the recipe is that it's open to improvisation. Start with good corn, which is the star of the dish. Fresh corn is perfect, though my frozen summer corn worked well, too. We use chopped Cajun pork or pure pork sausage for our meat seasoning, though you can use a pound of chopped ham or bacon instead. Mock shoe can be served alone in a bowl, like chowder or succotash, or over rice. It's a nice, filling dish to share with a full table. Here are the ingredients. you need 6 ears of corn, shucked. 3 tablespoons of olive oil. 2 celery stalks, chopped. 1 red bell pepper, chopped. 1 onion, chopped. 1 pound of smoked sausage, diced. 1 cup heavy cream. 1 teaspoon cayenne pepper. 1 teaspoon thyme. 1/2 teaspoon smoked paprika. And salt and pepper to taste. Now the directions, there's only 4 steps here. Number 1, heat olive oil in a large pan or wok. And then add chopped vegetables, except corn, and the sausage. Sauté until tender. Number 2, add corn and seasonings, except salt and pepper. Stir until combined. Number 3, reduce heat and add cream. Let simmer until the liquid has reduced slightly, about 10 minutes. And number 4, season with salt and pepper to taste. Makshu can be served with toasted French bread and a garden salad as sides. All right, I might even make that myself. I have to find something to substitute for heavy cream, but I might make that. And now for the Monitor's View in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are 2 of them, and I got plenty of time to read them. The first one is entitled Thanksgiving as Forgiving. For many Native Americans, Thanksgiving is often seen as a day of mourning, a reminder of what their peoples lost at the hands of European settlers and their descendants. This year, however, that dark history saw a blush of light. On October 25th, President Joe Biden stood before the Gila River Indian community in Arizona and apologized on behalf of the federal government for the forced removal of Native American children to assimilation schools. Coming at the start of a season in which Americans count their blessings among family, friends, and strangers, that gesture of national atonement fits into a shift in recent years toward a broader reading of past abuses of indigenous people. "We do not erase history. We make history," Mr. Biden said. "We learn from history, and we remember so we can heal as a nation." Apologies often open a pathway to reconciliation. Any remorse, however, even if it's only official, relies ultimately on a response of forgiveness in order to bring a mutual feeling of justice. Instead of looking at the apology for what it isn't, wrote Anton Truer, a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University in Minnesota, we should look at the apology for what it is, an opportunity to set a new tone for our country and start a healing journey. "The only way through this is together," he wrote in the Minnesota Star Tribune. Under the Indian Civilization Fund Act of 1819, hundreds of thousands of children were taken from their families and scattered throughout government-funded schools. Most were deprived of their names, their languages, and their families. Many died because of abuse. Much of that policy endured into the 1970s. Several initiatives aim to repair the damage. Bills in Congress, for example, would establish a commission to forge a common narrative through the testimonies of separated families. A Senate bill requires that members of the panel be persons of recognized integrity and empathy with an understanding of Native American approaches to healing and reconciliation. The legislation coincides with a 2-year investigation by the U.S. Department of the Interior into abuses under the school policy and a Road to Healing listening tour, which completed last year through a dozen Native American communities. Together with the presidential apology, the combination of acknowledgement and accountability may do more than shape a new narrative of past harms or lead to material forms of restitution. A novel college experiment shows how. Last year, the University of Mary Harding Baylor in Texas restored a long-lapsed tradition of making Thanksgiving a day of forgiveness. Every student was required to offer a gesture of reconciliation before sitting down to the holiday meal. The effort was as transformative as it was challenging. I love the concept of intentionally forgiving people right before Thanksgiving so you can be thankful with a grateful and unburdened heart, recalled Danielle Ken, the then a senior, in a recollection published by the university in June. I never really considered how forgiving others could affect my ability to be truly thankful, and it made me want to spend time in prayer about forgiveness before Thanksgiving. Our next Monitor's View article is entitled, A Shield for Gaza's Innocent. After nearly 14 months of destruction, the war in Gaza has taken an unexpected turn for peace. In a religious ruling, the most prominent Islamic scholar in the Palestinian enclave says Hamas failed to keep its fighters away from the homes of defenseless Palestinian civilians, or, in effect, the group used innocent people as shields against Israeli strikes or attacks on Hamas positions purposely placed in or under civilian buildings. Human life is more precious to God than Mecca, stated Professor Salem Adaya, a former dean of the Faculty of Sharia and Law at the Hamas-affiliated Islamic University of Gaza. The BBC, which reported on the religious edict, notes that Dr. Daya cites Islamic principles that require Hamas to avoid actions that provoke an excessive and disproportionate response by an opponent. In the past, Dr. Daya has been respected enough to mediate disputes between Islamic militant groups within Gaza. His edict, or fatwa, could now further undercut Hamas's claim that much of its legitimacy rests on its obedience to Islam. Since the group's October 7th attack last year on Israeli civilians, many in the Muslim world have debated how much Islamic law and international law apply to the conflict in Gaza. Dr. Daya's ruling echoes similar calls by Jewish scholars for the Israeli military to honor international and Jewish law by protecting Palestinian non-combatants in both Gaza and the West Bank. The core of the differences between Israelis and Palestinians is the ability and willingness to empathize with innocent victims on both sides, wrote Singapore-based scholar James Dorsey after the October 7th attack. Such empathy is shared by the three Abrahamic faiths of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Well, guess what? We've got a lot of time left. The cover story was about 15 minutes, and it's usually around 25 or so, so that's why we got all this time left. So, as usual, I go to the global newsstand in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is, it tells the name of a newspaper, where it's from, it's got a headline, and then a paragraph. So here we go. The Times of Israel from Jerusalem. As Trump wins, Netanyahu nears absolute authority. Donald Trump won the U.S. presidential election just a few hours after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu brusquely advanced a dramatic comeback of his own, ousting his only significant coalition dissenter, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, writes founding editor David Horowitz. In acute contrast to Trump's historic comeback, however, Netanyahu's has been achieved without recourse to the electorate and without him having acknowledged his prime responsibility for the failures that enabled the Hamas invasion on October 7, 2023. The next concern is that he will subjugate the judiciary to the political majority. This would give the prime minister near absolute authority, and that would constitute not just a comeback, but a vast surpassing of the powers he held before October 7th. The next one is from the Daily Maverick, which is from Cape Town, South Africa. The U.S. has a fresh chance to engage with Africa. It would be a mistake for Africa to give up on a Trump presidency based on ideological assumptions or personal prejudice, write Greg Mills and Ray Hartley, director and research director, respectively, of the Brenthurst Foundation, a Johannesburg-based economic development think tank. If Trump wants to cement his legacy with African people and not just its elites, he needs his policy to double down on the promotion of democracy. Trade and investment work best with countries that have open, democratic systems. Trump should support visa access, educational opportunities, increasing trade, and government training and technical help to democratic standards. This approach could ensure he has a meaningful African legacy, unlike his predecessors. Now from The Guardian from London, Trump's win spotlights misogyny. The left cannot give in. A nation that was once the beacon of the democratic world has knowingly elected a criminal who tried to overthrow the government, writes author and columnist Polly Toynbee. The tides will carry this poison across the Atlantic, invigorating Europe's hard right. On the morning of the result, I was speaking to U.S. students visiting the U.K. They talk of abortion rights and deep, dark misogyny. American men will not vote for a woman, one said. Would it be better to give up on all this angst? No, of course not. There is no escaping the danger of Trumpism, only escapism. Never give up, said the vanquished and exhausted Kamala Harris. Now from the Korea Joongang Daily from Seoul, South Korea. Export-reliant nations must brace for American protectionism. The Korean economy is under dark clouds as it faces the second presidency of Donald Trump, states an editorial. His protectionist policies can devastate export-reliant economies like Korea's. Trump has warned of blunter decoupling from anything related to China by slapping as high as a 60% universal tariff on imports from China. The move will adversely affect Korea, whose trade with China mostly involves intermediate components for finished products in China to be sold in the United States and other countries. Trump has vowed to revisit current policies like the Inflation Reduction Act and the Chips and Science Act, which can baffle Korean companies who invested billions of dollars in the country. Our government must do its best to protect the interests of Korean companies by reminding its U.S. counterpart of the escalated bilateral relationship on the economic and technological front. And the last one here is from The City Paper from Bogota, Colombia. U.S.-South America alliances could now shuffle. Donald Trump's decisive victory in the U.S. presidential election presents a momentous opportunity for the incoming Republican administration to strengthen its presence across Latin America, writes Richard Emblin, director of the City Paper. President Gustavo Petro's administration in Colombia is openly critical of the United States' role in global affairs. Argentina's President Javier Milei, in contrast, expressed his congratulations for Trump's formidable election victory. Milei's statement echoed similar messages from other right-wing Latin American leaders in El Salvador, Brazil, and centrist Uruguay. Will the Colombian leader find a way to balance his leftist agenda with the realities of U.S. power and influence in the region? All right, all that was compiled by Nate Eaglehart and Jacob Posner, who are staff writers. Well, we still have almost 3 minutes left. So I'll read this little article. Hopefully it fills the remaining times. It's in the Perspectives section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly underneath a subsection called Behind the Scenes. And it is entitled, Why We Let Taiwan Tell Its Own Story. The story of Taiwan is often framed in terms of China or the United States. Its own narrative is more complex. And this is written by Lindsay McGinnis, who is the Asia editor, and Jingnan Ping, who is a multimedia producer. There we go. China sees Taiwan as a breakaway province that will someday be united with the mainland, possibly by force. But the self-governing island increasingly views itself as a distinct country with its own laws and culture. Its people overwhelmingly want to maintain local autonomy. On Taiwan, about two-thirds of people consider themselves to be purely Taiwanese, and only 2% see themselves as purely Chinese, says Beijing Bureau Chief Ann Scott Tyson on our Why We Wrote This podcast. That is a big shift from several decades ago. This shift in national identity coincides with Taiwan's transformation from an island under martial law in the 1980s to a thriving democracy of 23 million today. In bustling cities and sleepy coastal towns, Anne met farmers, security experts, indigenous leaders, and young protesters who are feeling the pressure to protect that progress amid hostility from China. She also witnessed a growing civil defense movement, one taking lessons from Ukraine on how to respond to mass casualty events. What Anne didn't see? Panic. People are just sort of calmly learning some skills, she says, that could be helpful in many circumstances. Whatever happens, the people of Taiwan are not willing to go backwards. They very much treasure their freedoms, says Anne. Now, let's see, there's something here that says podcast. Staff writer Ann Scott Tyson recently joined the Monitor podcast, Why We Wrote This, to discuss her in-depth reporting on Taiwanese identity. And it says, for the full interview, go to www.csmonitor.com/whywewrotethis. Hey, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor Weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.